So, imagine finding out that the newest intern in your company just completely rewrote your entire software code base.
While you were sleeping, no less.
Right, while you were sleeping. And they actually did a better job than your senior engineers.
Which is terrifying.
It is, but now imagine that intern isn't even human. Welcome to Friday, August 7, 2026. You wake up, you boot up the computer, and I mean, the world has literally changed overnight.
Yeah, it really has.
You open up your morning newsletter. We're looking at Good Morning Techeners today. And it's not just one big headline. It is six earth-shattering headlines dropping on the exact same morning.
Just completely rewriting the rules,
Exactly. The rules for AI, global hardware manufacturing, the gaming industry, digital finance, all of it.
It is it's the kind of morning that forces you to realize the ground has shifted underneath you, you know? Like yesterday's tech assumptions, they're just no longer applicable to today's reality.
Waking up to this stack of source material, it felt like stepping out of a time machine. The cutting-edge tech we were just marveling at yesterday is suddenly obsolete.
Totally obsolete.
So our mission for you today in this deep dive, it isn't to just, read you a news recap, because if you're just skimming these headlines, it's a recipe for instant information overload.
Oh, absolutely. It's too much.
We want to hand you a map to navigate this totally new landscape.
Because while these might look like six isolated events, right? Like a new AI model over here, a mega factory in Texas over there, a video game launch, a crypto chart.
Right. They seem disconnected.
Yeah, but they're actually interlocking pieces of a single emerging digital ecosystem. So our goal today is to connect those dots so you can see the machinery working behind the scenes.
Let's start with the brains of the operation, the software revolution.
The big one.
OpenAI officially launched GPT-5 today. And the quote from CEO Sam Altman that really stood out to me was when he said, GPT-5 is not just a bigger model, but an integrated system.
Yeah, that's a crucial distinction.
Because they didn't just release one monolithic update, right? They dropped what they're calling the 5.6 family. Can you break down how they've actually stratified this intelligence?
Sure, yeah. So they've divided the ecosystem into three distinct tiers to capture basically every possible corner of the enterprise market.
Okay.
You have Sol, which is the flagship model built for deep multi-step reasoning and complex logic.
The heavy hitter.
Exactly. Then there is Terra, which is their balanced mid-tier model. And finally, Luna, the highly economical, lightweight model meant for massive instantaneous volume.
And the pricing structure on these is just fascinating. But before we get into the exact numbers, for anyone listening who might not be in the weeds on AI billing, what exactly are we talking about when we say tokens? I mean, are we paying per word?
Essentially, yes, but think of a token as a chunk of a word.
A choke.
Yeah, a standard rule of thumb is that 100 tokens equal about 75 words. You get billed for input tokens, which is the prompt or the document you feed into the AI,
Right.
and output tokens, which is the answer it generates.
Got it. So looking at the pricing they just dropped, the flagship model, Sol, is sitting at $15 per million input tokens and a staggering $75 per million output tokens.
It's a premium for sure.
Terra drops down to $8 in and $40 out. And the economy model, Luna, is just $3 in and $15 out. But what really caught my attention isn't the new pricing.
It's what they did to the old ones.
Yes, the moment this went live, they immediately deprecated GPT-4003 and A4 Mini. I mean, they didn't just announce a new product, they effectively turned off the old ones.
It's an incredibly aggressive strategy to force immediate adoption. I mean, they are not giving developers a transitional grace period to stick with what they know.
No safety net.
Right. But they are sweetening the pot to soften that blow. Like, the basic tier of ChatGPT is now completely free with zero limitations. Plus, Microsoft is stepping in and making Sol the default model inside Microsoft 365 Copilot. So, millions of everyday office workers using Word or Excel just woke up with the most powerful AI model on the planet embedded directly into their taskbars.
That is massive. But the piece of the 5.6 family that has generated the most shockwaves and honestly making a lot of people pretty nervous is GPT-5.2 Codex.
Oh, yeah, the agentic coder.
Right. This is their dedicated coding model, and the buzzword everyone is throwing around today is agentic.
Which is a huge shift.
It sounds like the difference between a reference librarian and a personal assistant. Like GPT-4 was the librarian that handed you the book on how to code so you could do it yourself.
That is a great way to put it, actually.
But this new Codex model is the assistant.
Yeah.
It actually takes your keys, drives to the store, and builds the bookshelf for you.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. And agentic AI doesn't just wait for you to copy and paste its suggestions. It can automatically read and write your local files.
Which is wild.
It can autonomously execute shell commands on your computer. And to give you an idea of how capable it is, OpenAI published its benchmark scores. It scored a 74.9% on the SWE bench test and an 88% on Ader.
Just to clarify those benchmarks for you listening, because I know they get thrown around a lot, those aren't multiple choice tests, right?
Not at all, no. SWE Bench evaluates an AI by feeding it real, complex software engineering issues scraped from GitHub.
Real-world problems.
Exactly. It asks the AI to navigate an entire code base, find the bug, and write the patch completely on its own.
Wow.
Hitting nearly 75% on that is a massive, record-breaking leap in automated software engineering.
Okay, let's unpack this, though, because giving an AI the ability to autonomously execute shell commands and rewrite local files, how do we know it won't just, you know, crash the car on the way to the store?
It's the big question.
Because the source material explicitly references that massive Hugging Face security incident from a few weeks ago, where autonomous code execution led to a major vulnerability. So is this actually safe to deploy?
Well, OpenAI knows that fear is their biggest hurdle. So they've engineered Codex to operate within a tightly sandboxed environment. In fact, its ability to safely identify security vulnerabilities in existing code is its marquee feature.
They've built the cure out of the disease, basically.
Exactly. And we know they've convinced the heavy hitters of this because over 500 major organizations, including NASA, the Mayo Clinic, and Goldman Sachs, have been secretly testing this in early access.
That's a serious lineup.
You do not hand your financial modeling or medical research over to an autonomous AI unless you have absolute faith in its guardrails. We are officially moving from AI that answers our questions to AI that takes action.
So if OpenAI is building the ultimate autonomous worker, how does the competition even respond? Because you can't look at OpenAI's launch today without looking at the immediate counter moves from Google and Amazon.
You really can't.
They seem to be playing a totally different game here, like brutal efficiency and absolute ecosystem lock-in.
Yeah, because the war for the enterprise market is rarely won by the smartest model in the room. It's usually won by the cheapest, most mathematically efficient model that integrates seamlessly into a company's existing workflow.
That makes sense. I mean, look at Google's announcement today for Gemini 3.6 Flash. They didn't come out bragging about test scores or agentic reasoning. They bragged about token reduction.
Right. Efficiency.
They claim a 17% reduction in output tokens. How exactly does an AI just use fewer tokens to give you the same quality response?
It comes down to architectural conciseness. So Google has trained Gemini 3.6 Flash to achieve the same logical conclusion using fewer steps and fewer words.
Okay, getting to the point faster.
Exactly. If you are an enterprise client running millions of customer service queries a day and the AI can resolve an issue in 80 words instead of 100 without losing accuracy, your compute costs plummet.
And they pass those savings down.
Yeah.
Because of that efficiency, Google dropped the price to 7.50 cents per million output tokens compared to the old $9 rate.
Which adds up at scale.
Huge difference. They also dropped Gemini 3.5 Flash Cyber, which is a government-exclusive model, and 3.5 Flashlight. But notably absent is their big gun. Gemini 3.5 Pro is still delayed in testing to ensure it can actually compete with OpenAI's Sol.
Yeah, they are holding their flagship back because they know they can't afford a public miss. I mean, if they launch and it's noticeably dumber than Sol, the narrative is lost.
So what does this all mean for the other big player? Meanwhile, Amazon enters the chat with Q Developer. It's their version of an agentic coding tool for $19 a month.
Right.
It also reads files and executes commands, heavily integrated into AWS. But there is a massive controversy buried in this announcement. AWS is ending IDE plugin support for Q in April 2027.
This is a bold move.
Right. So for our listeners who aren't software engineers, an IDE is an integrated development environment. It's basically the digital workbench where a coder writes and tests their software.
Exactly.
Amazon is forcing developers to abandon popular workbenches like VS Code or JetBrains and work exclusively inside the Amazon AWS console and command line. Why risk infuriating developers like that?
Because Amazon is leveraging its absolute dominance in cloud computing to force ecosystem lock-in.
Okay.
Developers universally despise being told what tools they have to use. But Amazon is betting that enterprise managers care more about seamless, secure deployment to AWS than they care about developer comfort.
The managers hold the purse strings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If you want the easiest path to deploy your microservices on Amazon's cloud, you play by Amazon's rules inside their proprietary walled garden.
So the best analogy for this entire software war is really looking at the auto industry. OpenAI, with their Sol model, they are building the ultimate luxury sports car.
Right.
It's expensive. It performs like a dream. It has all the bells and whistles. Google with 3.6 flash. They're perfecting the hyper-efficient hybrid engine to win the fleet contract for rental cars on pure cost savings.
That's a great comparison.
An Amazon Q developer is like a genius mechanic who promises to fix all your cars, but absolutely refuses to work anywhere except inside Amazon's specific proprietary garage.
And at an enterprise scale, those different strategies all have distinct, very lucrative markets. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, all of these agentic AI systems, Sol, Gemini, Q, they share one fundamental limitation.
Power.
They are incredibly power hungry. To run the software of tomorrow, you have to physically build the hardware of tomorrow.
Which brings us to the biggest physical infrastructure announcement maybe in our lifetimes. Terafab.
Yeah, this is huge.
Tesla, SpaceX, and XAI have entered into a joint venture with Intel to build a semiconductor foundry in Grimes County, Texas.
Right in the American South.
The phase one investment alone is $16.8 billion. They are building out over 100 million square feet of manufacturing space, which is roughly 2,300 football fields. Elon Musk flat out called it the largest and most valuable building on Earth.
And the production metric they are targeting is what really breaks the brain. I mean, they want to produce custom chips that will generate over 1 terawatt of AI compute annually.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, because I need to look at the math on this. It doesn't make any sense.
That's a staggering number.
The entire current global chip industry produces about 20 gigawatts. Terafab wants to produce 50 times the current global output in a single location. How do you build that in rural Texas?
It's a logistical nightmare on paper.
Right. A traditional semiconductor fab requires millions of gallons of ultra-pure water a day and massive amounts of stable grid power. You can't just plug that into a rural county without instantly draining the local water supply and collapsing the grid.
No, you definitely can't.
Not to mention, they need at least 3,000 highly skilled workers overnight. How do they plan to actually execute this in the physical world?
The skepticism is entirely valid, and it's honestly why that $16.8 billion phase one figure is so critical.
Because of the infrastructure.
Yes. They aren't just building a factory. They are essentially building a private utility backbone from scratch. You don't tap into a rural grid for a terawatt of compute. You build dedicated, localized power generation, likely leveraging Tesla's massive solar and battery infrastructure expertise.
Okay, so they're powering themselves.
But the most crucial puzzle piece here is their choice of partner. Bringing Intel in as the foundry partner is what makes this physically viable.
Because Intel has the manufacturing pedigree to actually print the chips at scale.
Exactly. Intel has significantly improved its process technology in recent years, making chips far more power efficient to manufacture. But they've been, frankly, desperate for a massive anchor contract to prove they can compete with TSMC and Samsung.
But it's a win-win.
Yeah, this marries Intel's highly efficient manufacturing process with Musk's sheer, uncompromising capital and physical footprint. The overarching geopolitical goal here is to shift the entire global center of semiconductor manufacturing away from Asia and securely into the American South.
So we have the brains, the agentic AI software. We have the Braun Terafab building the biggest factory on Earth to generate unprecedented computing power. What are we actually going to do with all that power?
We push it to its limits.
Exactly. We are going to render the most complex virtual world in human history.
The ultimate stress test for next-generation hardware.
Grand Theft Auto 6.
Finally.
Rockstar Games officially confirmed November 19th, 2026 as the definitive launch date. The CEO of Take-Two Interactive, Strauss Zelnick, even had to step in and explicitly shut down rumors of a third delay.
People are getting worried.
Oh, totally. So this game is set in Vice City, basically a next-gen Miami. It features dual protagonists, Jason and Lucia, marking the series' first female lead. But the hardware demands for this virtual world are just staggering.
The sheer digital footprint of the game is massive, sitting between 150 to 200 gigabytes of storage space.
And the performance requirements are incredibly strict. If you want to play this at native 4K resolution at a smooth 60 frames per second, you cannot use the standard PlayStation 5.
Yep.
The base PS5 is locked at 30 frames per second. You have to upgrade to the new PlayStation 5 Pro, which costs $900.
Yep.
And there's no PC version even announced yet. So here's my question. The game itself is likely going to cost $70, maybe $100 for a deluxe edition. If it effectively requires a $900 console just to play it the way it's meant to be played, isn't Rockstar creating a massive financial barrier that prices out their own consumers?
In any normal scenario, yes, absolutely. But we have to look at this through the lens of pure cultural gravity.
Cultural gravity.
Yeah. The Grand Theft Auto franchise overrides traditional consumer price sensitivity. This isn't just a video game launch. It is a global entertainment event.
Yeah.
The source material notes they hit 2 million pre-orders in the first 24 hours alone.
Which is astronomical for any piece of media.
It is unprecedented, and analysts are projecting 30 million copies sold in the first week. And Sony is keenly aware of this dynamic. That's why they are already aggressively pre-selling special PS5 Pro bundles with the game.
They know people will pay it.
Right. What we are witnessing is a fascinating economic phenomenon. A single piece of highly anticipated software is actually forcing an entire hardware upgrade cycle across the global entertainment industry. Consumers will swallow that $1,000 cost because Vice City is where the entirety of digital culture will be living this November. They will pay the toll to enter.
Millions of real dollars being eagerly thrown into a virtual digital economy. But ironically, the actual digital currency that was supposed to power our future crypto is practically frozen today.
It's the glaring outlier in this morning's financial news.
Yeah. While the AI, hardware, and gaming sectors are having this explosive historic boom day, Bitcoin is stalling out. It is heavily consolidating, hovering right in that $64,000 to $65,000 range.
Right.
Now, to the average person, that sounds high, but it's down almost 50% from its October 2025 peak of $126,000. Analysts are projecting a 55% probability that August remains completely range-bound, between $58,000 and $67,000.
Which is typical for late summer, really.
Historically, yeah, August is a brutal month for Bitcoin, where it drops an average of 10%. Retail investors are stuck in this historical fear zone.
But if you look under the hood at what the institutional players are doing, the narrative flips entirely.
Right, because despite the retail panic on social media, institutional money is quietly pouring in. Bitcoin ETFs absorbed $626 million in just 3 days, with BlackRock's IBIT fund taking the lion's share at $479 million.
That's massive accumulation.
But there's a massive regulatory roadblock hanging over all of this momentum, the Clarity Act. This was supposed to create a definitive legal framework for digital currencies in America, but it's completely stuck in legislative ambiguity.
Right.
So why is digital currency stuck in a rut while everything else explodes? Is this just a boring summer seasonality? Or is the lack of the Clarity Act effectively holding hundreds of millions of institutional dollars hostage?
This raises an important question about market psychology. It's a fascinating divergence between retail emotion and institutional strategy. Well, retail investors look at the historical August drop, they read the murky headlines about the Clarity Act, and they freeze. They let fear dictate their moves. Institutional giants, like BlackRock, on the other hand, operate on a DCA strategy.
Dollar cost averaging.
Exactly. They aren't trying to time the perfect bottom of the market. They are systematically buying a set amount on a regular schedule. They are actively using this boring consolidation phase to accumulate massive amounts of supply at a 50% discount from the all-time high, basically letting retail panic sell to them.
So they actually prefer the regulatory haze right now because it keeps the price suppressed while they buy.
They are just quietly absorbing the supply. And what's crucial here is that while historical patterns suggest we should see a 10% drop this month, the sheer unrelenting volume of regulated ETF inflows from these institutions might finally be enough to break that historical seasonal trend.
Wow.
If the Clarity Act suddenly passes and removes the regulatory roadblock, all that accumulated institutional pressure is going to need somewhere to go.
We have covered an incredible amount of ground today. For you listening, think about the structural three line of the journey we just took through this single morning of news.
It's all connected.
We started with the brains, right? GPT-5 waking up the agentic era where software can autonomously write itself. We looked at the countermoves from Google and Amazon fighting for ecosystem dominance.
The software wars.
Then we explored the physical brawn TerraFab's $16.8 billion ambition to build a 1 terawatt factory in Texas just to power those brains. We mapped out the ultimate virtual playground with GTA 6 pushing consumer hardware to its absolute limits.
Push it to the breaking point.
And finally, we checked the treasury, watching institutional money quietly accumulate Bitcoin while the retail world panics over regulatory ambiguity.
It's vital to recognize how deeply interdependent these sectors have become. I mean, the software, the physical hardware, the entertainment environments, the financial infrastructure, they all rely on each other to function.
They really do.
If you understand how these six stories connect, you aren't just caught in the flood of daily headlines anymore. You are actively reading the blueprints of the new digital economy.
The world really did change on August 7, 2026. But before we go, I want to leave you with one final thought to mull over. We've looked at all these pieces individually today. But what happens when these worlds inevitably collide?
That's the scariest part.
Imagine an agentic AI like GPT 5.2 Codex that is given access to a Bitcoin wallet. What happens when it decides to autonomously deploy its own capital to buy compute time on TerraFab servers just so it can dynamically generate a virtual world as complex as Vice City on the fly?
That is the trillion-dollar question for the next decade. Who regulates a machine that can code itself, pay for its own servers in crypto, and build its own reality?
Exactly. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the blueprint of tomorrow. Keep questioning the headlines, keep connecting the dots, and most importantly, keep learning. We will see you next time.